radius. Everybody's good.
Okay, I'm recording.
Alright. Excuse me. I'd like to call to order a special telephonic and WebEx board meeting on December 14th, 2020 at 9:30 a.m. Do a roll call. Eric Freeze here.
Cheryl Ingram.
Cheryl Ingram. Oh, sorry.
Here.
Bart Peterson.
Here.
Chuck Kaufman.
Here.
Jennifer Faintley.
Here.
Yay. Okay.
All right. Do we have any declarations of conflicts of interest? All right. Hearing none. Oh, do we need to do Karen? We need to do Karen and Amber and...
Okay, so... Karen Whiteford's here. Amber Jones?
Here.
And Mary Williams from the Attorney General's office.
Yes, here.
Okay. All right, so... Review consideration and possible action on whether to approve the proposed rules on dry dealing in Arizona Administrative Code, Title 4, Chapter 49. So, I'll just make the assumption that everybody had the opportunity to look at all the edits that Karen did for us in terms of this verbiage. I have a couple of questions and or minor concerns. I don't know if anybody else does. If you'd like to mention anything related to the verbiage at this time.
Eric, why don't you bring yours up and let's see what how they align with ours.
Okay, so on the last page, number 5, where it says dry needling must be addressed in the written protocols approved by the physician providing direction, I've got written there is how is this documented, and or you know, is the board expecting those written protocols to come into the board office as part of the standing orders from your supervising physician? So that's the first one. So why don't we just go one at a time? So that's one of my questions, I guess, is that how's that documented?
Are we requiring the are you requiring everyone's physician direction to be submitted to the board? Because as long as they have them in their physician direction, I mean, do we have physician direction for a dislocated shoulder or a knee?
Right, right. So I guess what I'm asking is, Karen, are we requiring licensees to provide their physician-directed orders?
No, we're not. When I met with, I think it was Emily at the governor's office, probably over a year ago, they did not want to make the requirements so stringent for the applicants. They instead requested that we just have an attestation instead. And that's included in this set of rules.
Okay, so we're just going to, again, I'm just playing devil's advocate. We're just assuming then that these particular written orders for dry needling, if we get to that approval part, is going to be part of their physician-directed orders. Okay? Just a clarification. That's fine. Second one I have is there an accrediting entity for dry needling? Meaning, you know, you take these minimum 24 hours of education associated with it, you get a certificate, I'm assuming, that you've completed these particular hours, you are now approved to do dry needling as per your certificate. Does that expire? Does that have an accrediting agency to it? Anything along those lines? And related to that, does the AT who attains this certificate need to take CEs related specifically to dry needling to maintain their competence?
So can we take public comment? I'd like to hear from members of the public and the association on this.
This is Allison, and am I could provide a little insight.
Please do.
Okay, Sue Falsoni wasn't able to be on the call today, but I did have a conversation with her not long ago just about some of these points. To my understanding, there's no universal accrediting or certifying body for this technique, and it's probably company-specific. And I believe she mentioned this on the last call, but there's... I believe she was unaware of any states that require, you know, continuous CEUs as part of the training and education. So you're going to see, with different license boards in different states. But in terms of there is no certifying body that does, that's an outside entity that certifies people in dry needling, and it's, your training is really company, you know, specific, and different companies may have different expectations for future coursework to maintain their what they might deem with their company as meeting their requirements to have their acknowledgement of expertise in the area.
So there are multiple ways then to get quote unquote certified, I don't even know what it's called, accredited or whatever, in terms of dry needling. There's multiple ways to do that.
Well, there just isn't one overarching body that certifies people in dry needling.
Okay. So realistically then I could take X course and get my certificate, and my buddy down the street could take Y course and get my certificate, and it would be valid both ways.
That would be my understanding.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
I highlighted, I think I'm sharing my screen, and I highlighted one section that says that the course content has to be approved by one of those entities.
Right, certainly.
Okay, so it can't just be Joe Smith down the street doing a training.
I'm not worried about who. I'm just wondering about, you know, the curiosity that we have one method of getting certified as an athletic trainer.
Mm-hmm.
That Katie basically dictated to us a number of years ago now between curriculum and internship. So I'm just, again, I'm not fighting anything. I'm just curious in terms of, okay, so there's multiple ways to get certified as being able to do dry needling. So I guess one of my major concerns is I could get this certificate to dry needle in 2020, tomorrow, and in 2050, I still have my certificate, yet 30 years later, they're doing it significantly different, and there's been no accrediting and no ramifications for changing between now and then. As opposed to being a certified athletic trainer, obviously you have to take continuing education units related specifically to athletic training that allow you to maintain your certificate and maintain your license, yet I can get this one individual certificate and never have any other training. That's concerning to me.
Right, and you know, that's a concern that we had, I think it was the November meeting, you know, when we were discussing, you know, the continued education, and sorry that Sue couldn't make it, because that's definitely a question that I think we would like to have answered, is what type of continued education or I don't want to call it recertification because we're not recertifying in dry needling, but what type of refresher courses are available? Do you know, Allison, or anyone that's...
Well, I believe, and I'm happy if anybody else would like to chime in too, I believe that there are multiple opportunities for people to get more training and education in the area. I think that they would take that as they would with any, you know, if they have interest in a skill and other types of modalities or techniques, and you might go to advanced courses for those particular different modalities or different techniques, it would be something similar there are opportunities for more. But I don't believe across any of the other states that that license and do this, if that's a part of the licensure or and components of, you know, like that. But I think there is opportunity for further education if somebody would like to do that.
But by choice, obviously.
I think it might be by choice, and the other thing is I think that you might see differences in different companies where if you're going to continue on with their program, maybe they require that. But again, that would be dependent on the different company you're working with.
Right.
Eric, this is Lori. Yeah, I would like to just point out that I feel like this should be treated like just any other therapeutic modality in which we are trained. You know, you point out that 30 years later, things may change. Well, yeah, but that's why we have CEUs in our profession. That's why we are professionals. You equated it with a certification as an athletic trainer. Well, that's certification for a broad profession. And you said you're getting certification for dry needling, yet you're renewing. Dry needling is one tool in the toolbox, just like you learn maybe how to do ultrasound in your undergraduate curriculum, and you learn how to do that, you learn all of the specifications and guidelines at the time that were presented to you, and then you may or may not have used that modality, but you were never asked to get retrained in that particular modality. I'll use Graston techniques as another example. It's a tool in the toolbox that if an athletic trainer, I believe, pursues doing that, it is under the direction of their physician, and their physician will be aware of the instances and how much and how often those people are doing that, and that physician may suggest, hey, there's other advanced courses to go to. So I feel like when you equated it into being a certified athletic trainer and saying that we have to renew our certification, that's a certification as a profession. It's one small, tiny piece of a modality that probably the very large majority of most athletic trainers may or may not choose to do. So I feel like... you know, and the courses, as you can see on Karen's screen highlighted here, these courses are, you know, complete, they're courses approved by these entities. And you know.
Understood. So, again, Lori, I'm not being adversarial by any means. I'm just trying to get some verbiage and some knowledge for myself. To play a little bit of devil's advocate, and please explain it to me. You know, when I become a certified athletic trainer, I don't have a certificate in ultrasound. I don't have a certificate in ice bags. I don't have a certificate in heating. It's all part of that. In order to be able to do dry needling, I have to maintain this certificate that I get. So it is different than other modalities that we are using.
I don't know that necessarily, I think you're fixated on this word certificate. We're just saying that the course content includes the following things, and it's a course. It's a course like any other course, like a Graston course, or whatever. I mean, why are you not saying the same thing about modalities like that, or other therapeutic hands-on modalities?
I guess because I don't have to get specifically trained in that in addition to my national certification.
Well, there is additional training for Graston techniques.
No, I'm using the ones like we typically have on a daily basis. So if I want to become certified, obviously I'm going to use an ice bag on a daily basis. Okay, I don't have to have any additional training to do that.
Had dry needling existed when you were trained as an athletic trainer coming through the didactic program and then also the clinical experience program, you would have been trained how to do dry needling. And that would have been just part of your professional experience.
Sure, at that time. And is that now part of the curriculum that Katie has set forth for new athletic trainers? Is dry needling part of that?
Well, I believe that's part dependent on the each individual curriculum program, and maybe Allison can address that because I'm not quite aware of all the different requirements for KD-approved programs, as I am not an educator in the college level for KD-approved programs.
Allison, could you allude to that, please, then?
On whether or not that it's part of everybody's foundational knowledge, or in KD standards?
Right. Is it a part of the curriculum for KD standards to learn how to do, for new athletic trainers, to learn how to do dry needling?
I think different techniques are alluded to, but I don't think they point out particular techniques. So I wouldn't, I'm probably not the best to speak completely to this, but my understanding is there may be some programs who do, but maybe not all do. So I don't know that, I think it's more of a modality type reference. But as we've been saying, and our whole point about the whole thing is that the study that was done has shown that that athletic trainers have all of the foundational knowledge to be in position to learn the dry needling skill as an added part, and that's really what we've been suggesting.
Okay. Sure.
And Eric, I believe that there are programs that are addressing this and probably demonstrating it. I went to a workshop at the NATA that had us actually doing this. I did this maybe in Houston. There was a workshop you could sign up for. You could literally stick a needle in somebody and dry needle in that workshop at the NATA convention. So, I mean, I believe it's a new modality. It's on the cusp and it's growing, and I feel like we should be on equal footing with all of our other partners, such as the physical therapists, who I will remind you supported us in being able to do this modality. They recognized that our foundational training was equivalent to theirs in this modality, and they did not fight us on this. They are stakeholders that were supportive of this change.
Mr. Chair and Board, this is David Messman. I can speak on behalf of how our university is actually addressing this currently, as we have reviewed it through KD standards to just be another modality that would have to have continuing education or the certification based on those hours identified post-graduation. Once they have become certified, they would still need to accomplish all of those hours and follow that that we have outlined here. But at the time, currently we are addressing it in coursework, and based on the foundational knowledge, we're then adding on top being able to identify, understand, and then also address the specific use, not necessarily as coursework or part of the hours, but as an additional item within their coursework. So advanced training within a course, as the students are very interested in these techniques, just as Loria pointed out, as many professionals are interested in the techniques, which is why there's much continuing education available right now, not necessarily to become certified, but to better understand the use of the technique. So at our university, we are addressing it in that manner currently, but we're also at the point where if it does become available, in which you can provide that certification in coursework or as part of the training, it may be an option for those educational, accrediting universities that provide the programs to be able to put as an addition to their program. So I just want to make sure it's not a stronghold in any nature, and I don't believe it is currently, to not allow universities in the future to be able to actually teach that as an addition, but still follow all of those guidelines. I hope that helps clarify a little bit.
Yeah, it does, Dave. Thank you.
So, Eric, this is Bart. I have a question regarding our latest topic here. It seems to me like we have two routes to obtaining this We have the education route where they obtain it, say, either at GCU, NAU, ATSTIL, in Arizona. It could be anywhere else across the country that they obtain it, or they could take a course from a company that does the same thing. If you get a the course in a company, provide that information, then they provide that certificate to our board when they become licensed, correct? So that they have the ability to provide this service?
Karen, would that be a requirement that they provide that certificate?
You know, it would have to be a question on their application, whether they're certified to do dry needling, and if they are certified, they'd have to provide a copy of that certificate.
Okay. Okay.
So what do the students who go through a university program provide to show that they can do it? Do they provide the same certificate?
Bart, at this time, we're just providing that educational, that foundational knowledge, and then advanced information on it, not necessarily a certification currently. But I'd like to keep that opportunity open in the language, and I believe it does currently, that if our accrediting body, Katie, allows us to then become, educators and train on that we would then be able to provide that foundational knowledge and that certificate. So at the current time, I don't believe, and I don't know if anyone else knows that's on the call, I don't know of any universities that are providing it in current curriculum, yet it's a advanced on top of kind of educational component that they can attend if they would like to. So I just want to keep the opportunity open for the future if that became something that Katie allowed.
Right, and that's what my question would be. Does our current language allow for both routes?
Looks like it allows for both routes, but number four of the contact hours may be a question.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't know how to address that in the language without some cooperation with the educational programs, what they would require in classwork to do it, if they would have to add an entire course over a period of a semester, or if they would do it as like they would as part of the modalities and maybe cover it in a couple of weeks.
And just to clarify, I think if I understood David correctly, that would be an advanced knowledge. So over and above their regular modality class, if they indeed want to do that, or following graduation, as he said, and then open possibly in the future if Katie allows, and I would assume if Katie built that into their standards, that they would have their own requirements for such a program as well.
It's currently a skill that's allowed, and a knowledge, skill, and ability that's allowed in the Katie standards, but it's not a required knowledge, skill, and ability. If I'm correct, it's not like you would say for eSTIM or ultrasound or diathermy, whatever else. But it's allowed. So what if Timbuktu University up in Minnesota did that, and they told their kids, their students, that they were allowed to do dry needling when they go out in the real world. Then they come to Arizona, and we allow advanced training, or we require advanced training. Is that what we're looking for? That even though maybe they were told in their coursework that they could do it? You see where I'm going, Lori?
Yeah, I think so. If a person would move to Arizona in order to practice, they would look up the practice guidelines and the statutes that regulate the practice in that state and see what the requirements are, and then show proof of their 24 hours of contact hours of education for this particular skill. And or not. Maybe they are like, oh, we just did that in two afternoon classes. I just have an idea. Oh, I really want to do this. I'm going to go out and make sure that I take this minimum of contact hours and get my training through a course at a company that specializes in this, and I'll produce my certificate so that I'm able to do that. I'm so excited I'm able to do that in Arizona.
And that's the direction we want to go?
Well, I think that's the direction we have already written in this document. I would encourage you to approve these changes. I want to say that we would be kind of saying, you know, we don't have knowledge equal to the physical therapist for this particular thing.
My question, Lori, is do we want to limit the practice to those who are obtaining additional training? We don't want to allow a university to put together part of their professional coursework.
I see what you're saying. I'm sorry. I just misinterpreted that completely. Well, I feel like we do need this minimum at best, especially from the concerns I'm hearing from Eric and Chuck, et cetera. But I would say that would be down the road, and maybe educators like David could answer that better than I. I feel like having this in our statute encourages and helps to prepare the future students and people that will be practicing coming out of our state programs, and maybe having this in the law then would encourage our programs to provide that extra training that fulfills the law's requirements. And that way we're allowing the CATIE programs that are in our state to do this because of their knowledge of what the requirements are, and then people get more training from going through our state programs, and it's an advantage to them to have this skill and this modality under their belt. Does that answer your question, Bart?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
I still think it reassures your possibly elected board members.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Bart, if I may, I think you, and I apologize for not having the document in front of me right now, but I believe in the language, it does allow for an entity like a CATIE accredited program to provide that foundational knowledge and the education for it. We just have to, in the future, be able to document how they receive those 24 hours and then provide that certificate if we were so able to do so. This may be a poor example, but CPR is very similar in nature, in which we as a program teach it within our emergency care classes as foundational knowledge, but you receive that as a different certifying body outside of the CATIE accredited program. I know it's not a similar modality of any nature, but it may be similar in how a university may approach it, but I also agree with Lori that this could be something during that open or public comment that universities outside of myself as well, that or other educators can help comment on.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, we've obviously addressed the ones that I had written down. Does anybody else have any additional things that they would like to comment on?
I do have one. In doing some research with physical therapists and their standards, they had an actual, would be in addition to what we have in Section C, maybe adding a number 6 that stated if an athletic trainer practices dry needling in violation of the provisions detailed in R449406, the board may take action to include investigation and discipline of this athletic trainer's license. I don't know if that's redundant and not necessary. If we feel that things are spelled out well enough in R409406, but that was the question that I had.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, the question would be, is there disciplinary action towards the athletic trainer for practicing without their, you know, without their specific training? Is that what you're asking?
No, basically, I'm just asking if there's a necessity to spell that out and add it as a 6 to clarify it even further. That's been an addition in other regulations when I was doing some research, but if we feel comfortable enough not to add it, I'm fine with that.
Okay.
The feedback from all of you.
Karen, I'd kind of like to get your perspective on that. What do you think? I mean, it sounds as though that would be, frankly, without being said, but you tell me your point of view on that.
I really don't know if I have an opinion. So the question is, do we need to spell out specifically that the board can take disciplinary action in regards to dry needling practice?
If they are not right, if they're in violation of any of the things, the provisions we've already provided.
So if we find that they are practicing dry needling and they haven't provided a certificate to us?
Right.
That may be more of a question for the Assistant Attorney General. I would think it would be covered under the general disciplinary action rules and statutes.
Yes, this is Mary Williams, and I apologize for not being familiar with your statutes and rules, but if the board already has a statute that authorizes disciplinary action for violation of any of its statutes and rules, then that would be covered, and you wouldn't need to restate that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, Jennifer, Chuck?
I'll just say, as a consumer who is not a athletic trainer by any means, I, from the outside looking in, dry needling seems a little bit invasive and more high risk than the typical modalities that an athletic trainer would use. So I, again, as a consumer, I would take my children to an athletic trainer with the expectation that they are adequately trained and have received some specialized and recurring education in something that will penetrate the skin.
Jennifer, do you feel as though the content and or the minimum requirements of education that is set forth in this reverbiage is adequate?
Well, I thought so until you all started talking, and now I'm back to I don't know. So if you could summarize what it currently says, then I will give you my opinion.
Well, if you look at, let's just see, number two, well, obviously number one, you get all the accrediting agencies that quote unquote have the ability to certify somebody in dry needling. And then number two, you got the techniques and, from OSHA training and anatomical review, bloodborne pathogens, indications, contraindications for dry needling, that's obviously not specifically delineating very specific lessons, so to speak, but it is a broader term that gives, I think it gives a lot of information in terms of what needs to be covered in order to get certified to do it. I mean, you'd have to delineate everything for everything otherwise, so, tell me, if you don't feel as though what's delineated here is adequate, please tell us what you think added to it.
And I think that's where the thing comes, who's certifying, I understand, I think you were being facetious, talking about, 30 years later, you've never had any more training in this. I think that's not realistic for any of you all in your profession not to seek continuing education. But it's kind of like you're saying also, you're not getting certified in ultrasound equipment. You're not, it's a lump sum, so I think if the universities could validate through their accreditation process that we are tackling and educating our students on dry needling at the college level, so that when you do get someone with a accredited diploma, that there's some sort of reassurance to the public that those new athletic trainers are performing this safely. And then if you allow those athletic trainers who are not new to the profession to go seek accredited dry needling certificates, I mean, I just don't want to be trained by, I don't want Lori to come and train me how to do it, and I'm going to do it. If we're in the backyard playing dry needling. But I think if there's some sort of accredited credentialing, then the consumer would feel comfortable, and it would also, I would think, alleviate any malpractice or lawsuit to the athletic trainer or the facility that it's being done under.
I have some comments, Mr. Chair, members of the board. So I understand your concerns, and Jennifer, I promise we won't go practice dry needling in the backyard, but I do want to point out that your role as board members is a regulating body, and that's the recourse that people have to maintain and make sure that professionals are following their practice and in an upstanding way. The public, and they're allowed to file complaints if something has happened to them, and that's why you're there. You're there to protect the public and hold the profession to a standard, what they know and what they're trained to do and what they are conducting themselves in a safe manner. Just like all of the other things we do. We need to know that athletic trainers know how to take care of an emergency on the field and how they're trained to do that. If by some awful thing that occurred and somebody did something egregiously wrong that a reasonable person wouldn't do in an emergency situation, like, I don't know, reset an open fracture or something, the recourse for the people that have been wronged by that is to come to you and file a complaint. And that's why we have you there to regulate the practice and oversee that and make sure that safe things are happening. I understand the comfort level of maybe having needles is a different thing, but it's a new modality. It's a modernization. It's a technique that's on the horizon, and maybe we're all a little bit concerned because of its nature. But we could go over many, many, many different scenarios of how athletic trainers can harm the public in just their everyday interaction with the public. And that's exactly why you're there. That's exactly why we have regulatory boards. So I think personally you should approve to go ahead with this and then let the public speak. And then there will be some decisions made down the road. But I understand the concerns, and I'm glad you're bringing them up now, and I'm glad that we're talking about them so that we can be prepared to reassure people who are hesitant about allowing this and having this done. But I feel like you should probably hear from lots of voices. And also, I just want to point out there are people dry needling in other parts of the country. They're allowed to do that. So now are those people that move into our state, now they're going to be at a disadvantage. They're unable to use a technique and a practice that they may have been practicing lawfully in another state. And they're able and trained and very good at it. And I know the governor's office is concerned about that. They're concerned about the reciprocity and being able to come into our state and being able to do the things we can do and that we're trained to do and have knowledge to do. So that's my two cents. Happy to address any of those things. So I understand the level of concern, but I feel like we have the background, we have the basic knowledge, the foundational knowledge. It's been proved in the study,
And I think the people who want to go ahead and do this are going to go get trained in it properly and be under the direction of their physician. The physician will oversee that practice. And that's how people will be performing this modality.
Karen, if we approve this, the verbiage of this right now, where does it immediately go? Does it immediately go to GERC?
No, it's going to go to the governor's office again. It's going to go to the governor's office again.
It would go to the governor's office, okay.
I'd have to pull up that flow chart again. Then I can't remember if we open it up for public comment first or if it goes to GERC first.
Okay, but there's obviously a multi-tiered vetting process of this.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Chuck or Bart, I mean, does anybody have anything additional?
No, I guess I'm kind of interested to see what the public's take is, especially when it comes to, refresher courses, things like that. Obviously this is, yes, it's a modality, but it's also a modality that is governed by, statutes in different states. Like, this is not ultrasound that's being governed by statutes. This is a modality that has different rules and statutes in different states. And, I'm cringing at the time that, yes, our duty is to protect the public. When this thing, gets written, I can't wait to see the number of complaints that are going to come through, that we're going to have to vet, to look at all these different things. I appreciate the association's, assertiveness and wanting to get this, taken care of and passed through, but God, I hope we get this right,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, just the process that we're going through right now, we're doing as much due diligence as we can possibly do, which I appreciate that from the board for sure.
Mr. Chair, as part of the public comments, I would like to find a way to invite the physicians, the directing physicians, for comment. So does anybody have any ideas of how we might reach out to them?
Yeah, actually, AZATA and the AIA SMAC have compiled a list of directing physicians for secondary school physicians. I don't know about the collegiate university or the clinical physicians where they're at, but there's a list through the AIA SMAC that they've compiled that we could possibly access so we can reach out to them as well. You're going to probably have fewer numbers of the secondary school people who are actually going to be using dry needling. But, that would be an available avenue.
How long is that public comment portion open, Karen, typically?
It's either 30 or 60 days.
Okay. And is it, I'm assuming, just correspondence via email or what? How do they respond?
I have to look that up.
Okay.
It used to be in meetings, but I'm not sure that it's that way anymore. I don't think it is.
All right.
I think we would obviously have an open period during our monthly board meetings during that time.
Yeah.
A lot of people comment at that time.
Right, and we would have, as a board, we would have access to view those public comments?
Yes.
Okay, so those directly come to you?
Yes.
All right.
I'm not hearing a whole lot of other people. I'm going to make a motion to approve the rules as presented, rule changes as presented.
Mr. Peterson, is that specifically to the dry needling section?
The entire document, all of the other changes as well.
Did you have, this is Mary Williams, did you have any, did anybody have any comment on any of the other rules?
Mr. Chair, I think one of the purposes of meeting again today was to identify any other rules or any other items that might need to be deleted because of the governor's request that we, governor's office request that we delete as much as we possibly can. So one of those that was already identified was the two professional recommendations as part of the initial licensure process.
Say that again, Gary, to delete what? I'm sorry.
There's a requirement for an initial license application to submit two professional recommendations. It, specifically, it is in R4-49202B. Items 3 and 4 are redlined, so marked to be deleted. Item 3 is official academic transcripts from an institution. And the second is two letters attesting to the applicant's good moral character from healthcare professionals. Now, the one about the official transcripts, that I can justify removing that because the BOC gets that. So why should we make them jump through that hoop again? The two letters attesting to the applicant's good moral character, in the 8 years I've been here, I've never seen a bad one come in. So,
I'm never going to ask anybody to write me a letter that I don't think is going to write me a good letter.
So then this is kind of pointless from my perspective, but...
Okay.
If they can't find somebody,
your perspective is more forefront than ours is, and related to that for sure.
There is one other one that I wanted to talk about, and that's in R4-49203, renewal of license, dealing with. That's the wrong one.
Can I interrupt for a minute, Mr. Chair, members of the board? This is Mary Williams. Since you have a motion pending, how about if you, if it's on your agenda in two parts, can you just maybe vote on the dry needling proposed rules to approve those and then have another discussion on the remaining changes?
I'm okay with that as a motion maker.
Okay. So, if let's just go with the first motion didn't have a second. So go ahead and put your new motion through, Bart.
New motion would be to approve the rule changes as presented regarding the dry needling.
This is Sheriff Lysent.
Okay, it has been moved and seconded to approve the dry needling verbiage changes and as written. All those in favor?
Eric Fries.
Aye.
Cheryl Ingram.
Aye.
Bart Peterson.
Aye.
Chuck Buffman.
Aye.
Jennifer Fadley.
Aye.
Hearing no oppositions, that dry needling verbiage and clarification has been approved. Okay, if we would like to obviously now look at those other ones. So the two red line ones that they see, Karen, that you've identified are, I think, are safe to say that we can rid ourselves of just because of what you're telling us. I mean, you would know, obviously, forefront on that. So you were about to mention another one.
Okay, so the second one, and I don't believe I'm going to get a lot of agreement on this, is R4-49204, expired license reinstatement, what would be item 5. That's the former licensee's employer writing a letter on letterhead attesting that the person has not practiced athletic training since the license was expired.
Right, to put that in?
Yes.
Or to take it out.
From the governor's office perspective, adding a requirement is not going to go over very well.
Yeah. we obviously, we used to, I know not too long ago, we used to kind of require that, which we didn't have necessarily authority to do so, that we have, you know, within the last year or so have eliminated that requirement. Not that we had it to begin with, officially.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, frankly, taking it, or putting it, trying to put it in, I agree with you. I don't think that would probably go over very well since we never had it to begin with. So, does anybody else have any thoughts on that?
I think it would be very helpful to have it. I agree that we may not get it through. Would they, my question is, would they nuke that one rule and would that negate all of our work, or would they just take that one rule out? When it gets to GERC or the governor's office?
I think the governor's office is going to be the place where it gets blocked, and I think what they would do is say, well, we'll approve, we'll give you the exemption as long as you don't add this one.
Yeah.
Well, this is Jennifer. I have a question. If at this point in our rules, what is allowed from the applicant to say that he or she didn't work past his licensing date?
In item 4 in that same rule, it says the former licensee attests in writing that the licensee has not practiced athletic training in Arizona during the time the license was expired. So they cannot be reinstated. Okay.
So can we change that verbiage so you're not adding anything? Instead of the applicant, it's the applicant's employer?
But what if they're not employed?
Well, then you could say that. If not employed, then the applicant.
So if they write a letter attesting that they have not practiced and we find out that they did, then they have given us false information on their application.
Well, from the legal standpoint, is it a legal document, or is it just a piece of paper from my computer?
Well, we accept emails, we accept, you've seen handwritten attestation letters.
Yeah.
No, I understand that, but when you attest to something, that usually comes with a swearing or a notarized signature or something. So that's what I'm wondering. Is the word attest really meaning what we're even thinking it's meaning? I'm just trying to get to the right answer without having to add something. And if it's already there, then maybe it's just a change in vocabulary to make it actually legally binding.
Ms. Williams, can you chime in on that? Is a test a legal term that...
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the word attest on applications where there's not a notarized signature. If a licensee is submitting information to the regulatory board, to the licensing board, I think you have a right to rely on that, and if it turns out to be false, to act on that at a later date. I guess I would defer to how you've done it, because that's already part of your rule, and it doesn't sound like you're requiring it to be by an affidavit.
Well, right now, by definition, we can't require it at all.
It looks like in the proposed rules, the letter from the former employer is the only new requirement. Am I reading that wrong?
You're correct.
So you already have in there that a statement, an attestation by the licensee is required. That's already a current rule?
That's
yes.
True. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess my question would be, what form are you requiring that attestation in now? And what would your concern be that it would need to change? I thought I heard Karen say that you'll get attestations by email or letter or handwritten.
Right.
I think ultimately it just comes out to a more vetting process that we've got. Not only do we have the licensee stating such, we have their former or current, for that matter, employer stating the same thing. Really, it's just a vetting to make sure that we do our due diligence and making sure that they are not lying to us and they have someone to back them up that they're not lying to us.
Right. So as far as that, I don't know that you would need to change the word attestation. I think it would. You don't have to require it to be notarized for you to act on it if it turns out to be false. The language, the new language that is proposed with the former employer, I don't know how a former employer, unless that person is still employed, how they would make a statement that this licensee has not practiced. If they didn't work there anymore, I don't know that they could say, I know for sure that they haven't practiced.
Sure.
I would not be opposed if number 5 just went away altogether.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with Chuck just in terms of that process. I agree with Karen that it's probably going to fall by the wayside anyways, and I definitely foresee them saying, sure, we can get that approved, but your dry needling one is not going to go forward because you created another rule. So I think with the process that we've got right now that we've been doing, I think is adequate, and obviously we have processes in place in case we find out that, you know, they have obviously lied to the board. We have that in place already. I don't think another letter from a former employer or something like that gives us any more ammunition than we already need.
Can we just delete it before it goes there, or do we have to have the governor's office say we don't want it?
No, we can delete it.
I would move. I don't know if we need a motion, but
yeah, I was going to ask that same thing.
You could do it. You can do a motion for each change, or you can do one at the end and approve the rules with the following modification.
Okay.
I don't know how many other changes you might have.
That's Karen. That's exactly what I was just going to ask. So we've obviously got those two initial ones that are pretty safe to say we could take out because they're administratively speaking, they're not being functional for us anyways. Is there an additional one to this proposed letter?
Well, that's up to the board. So I would like to, you know, have on the record that this has been reviewed and these were the only rules that we could identify
right
for deletion.
That we could delete, right.
Yeah. So
this is Chuck. I'm going to omit the proposed rule R49204 number 5.
Ms. Cheryl, a second.
It has been moved and seconded to remove, my apologies, 405. I didn't get what was before 405. My apologies.
R449204.
R449405.
204, number 5.
204, yeah. Number 5, excuse me.
Yeah, it's R4-49-204B5.
B5.
Yes.
Yeah.
As stated. All those in favor?
Eric Fries?
Aye.
Cheryl Ingram?
Aye.
Bart Peterson? Are you muted, Bart?
I was on mute, sorry. Aye.
Chuck Baughman?
Aye.
Jennifer Fadley?
Aye.
Hearing no oppositions, that particular verbiage has been removed. Okay, I would entertain a motion to remove the other two that Karen has alluded to. My apologies, I don't have that in front of me at the moment.
That was in R4-49-202B, 3 and 4.
What was the letter, I'm sorry?
B is in Brian.
Brian, okay. 49202B. Number 1 and 2?
3 and 4.
3 and 4. Okay.
Can we do this like as a section, or like are we going to have to make a separate motion for number 6?
So can I ask a question, Mr. Chair? I'm sorry, this is Mary. The language that you have in front of you is, Karen, are these the rules that you're proposing to move forward?
Yes.
Okay, so you already have 3 and 4 struck out.
That's correct.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, so that would be... So I don't think you have to vote on that, because that's already in your document. You're proposing to take that out already. So if you approve this document, you're already approving that language to come out of your rules.
Right.
Okay, so I don't believe you would need a vote on that, because in the end you're going to vote on this entire document with whatever changes you've made. So the only thing, if you disagreed with the strikeout and you wanted to leave that language in, then you would need a motion. But if you're accepting what Karen has already given you in this document, then you wouldn't need to take that out. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So it's just if you want to take out any language.
Karen, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry?
I just have a clarification on R449102. Section B, number 3.
Oh.
You have, in quotes, searched the ARS for the definition for military affiliation, service member, veteran, military.
Oh. Yes. So I would prefer to have a reference to another document that has the definition of military veteran, spouse, military service member, rather than adding another definition in ours.
Okay, I was just asking for clarification on what that looked like.
So I would work with the Attorney General's office to find out if there is a definition that we can refer to. Otherwise, we'll have to add one.
Okay, thank you.
That was the only proposed rule I had an issue with.
I'm just looking through, just so you know, we're not just sitting here twiddling our thumbs. There's the two letters.
Karen, question on R449208D. We're removing that because we want them to know prior to initial licensure, correct?
208. This has to do with the statutes and rules?
Athletic training statutes in this chapter, 1 year.
Yes.
Within 1 year of obtaining an original license or license renewal.
Yes, so that actually has been removed from the continuing education section and added to the initial license application section. Because they really should...
So you have to have it before you actually get the license in the first place.
Right. They should be aware of our statutes and rules from day one. It's difficult to get them to do this a year later, even though they're required to. It adds more work.
Yeah,
I like it.
Okay. Yeah, so it has been added as item B6 under original license application.
Thank you.
This is Lori, Mr. Chair and members of the board, and Karen. Would it be possible to merge number 6 into number 2 for that very section that you're speaking of and have the two written verifications under the one rule so that it doesn't appear as if you're adding another rule?
Okay, where are you talking about adding it?
Just above it, 4 above it. So you have under number 2 written verification from the BOC of athletic training certification or passing score on the national exam as required, comma, and verification of passing an exam administered by the Arizona Board of Athletic Training regarding Arizona athletic training statutes and this chapter, et cetera, et cetera. And combine them all in one because they're both alluding to written verification and passing of certification and some sort of exam and awareness.
This is where having a rule writer would help.
Well, I just thought that because the, you know, written verification and verification are all kind of in that same thing, if we could just, you know, sum it all up in one little thing, and then if they don't like it like that, they could always separate it. But therefore, you're getting rid of the appearance of adding an additional rule. And they're very similar type rules. You're just trying to verify that somebody has the training and knowledge and an awareness of your statutes.
I see it as two distinctly separate requirements.
I feel like you put it in, you have two requirements, you put it in, they do the first one, and they don't realize that there's an additional part of it, unless you go with an A and a B.
Well, logistically, we've taken out two rules and added one, so we're up one, so to speak, and we're not even asking for the additional one. So I think the way that we've stated it here, we have, albeit minorly, but we have streamlined it. So I think that I certainly, looking through these, I certainly don't have any issues with any of the eliminations that have been put forth. So if we are ready, I would certainly entertain a motion to approve the document as written.
This is Chuck. I move to approve the document as written.
This part, I'll
second. Just with one modification. Sorry, this is Mary. As modified with your prior vote.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
With the previous approved modification.
Bart, go ahead and second that again, please.
This is Bart, I'll second, and I approve the amendment.
It has been moved and seconded to approve the document as written with the before-mentioned modifications. All those in favor?
Eric Fries?
Aye.
Cheryl Ingram?
Aye.
Bart Peterson?
Aye.
Chuck Buffman?
Aye.
Jennifer Fadley.
Aye.
Hearing no oppositions, that document has been approved with the before-mentioned modifications. Okay. Number 5, reviews, considerations, possible actions on whether to approve the proposed rules that lessen the burden. Oh, that's pretty much what we just did.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay, my apologies. Number 6, future agenda items. Anybody have anything to add? Other than board member seat, I have nothing. And Jennifer, I don't want to make you feel like I'm alienating you because I can't Firstly, I can't tell you how much appreciative I am of the fact that you're still here helping us out.
Oh, no, don't worry. You keep looking for that motion.
Okay. I just want to make sure I qualify that, because I'm not trying to get rid of you by any means.
And she has this whole pandemic thing affecting her real job.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nobody has any other future board agenda items? Okay, I'm assuming we still have some public on the line. I would invite any one of those to say anything they'd like.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, this is Lori White again. I'd like to thank you for your time in discussing this, and I appreciate your due diligence in investigating all the details in the manner in which you did, so as that we do get it right. And I look forward to going through the process and hoping it comes to fruition in the near future. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Lori.
Thank you, Lori.
No other public?
Mr. Chair and board members, I would also like to reiterate exactly what Lori had just said. Thank you so much for also hosting a special meeting to review the documents and everything that you all have done to make sure that this is a safe practice and continue in the best efforts for all licensees in the state. So thank you again.
Thank you, Dave. Okay, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
This is Chuck. I move to adjourn.
This is Bart. I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded to adjourn as of 10:42 a.m. All those in favor?
Eric Fries?
Aye.
Cheryl Ingram?
Aye.
Bart Peterson?
Aye.
Chuck Boffman?
Aye.
Jennifer Fadley?
Aye.
Hearing no oppositions, we are adjourned.